Welcome to Believe is Question Worthy. And today we want to think about interpretations of the first chapters of the Bible. And we have a very special guest here today. I think we can say without offense that he is the world's leading apologist. Thank you, William Lane Craig, for taking the time to join us today.
Great to be with you, folks.
Before we turn to our topic, what connection do you have to Germany?
I did my doctoral studies in theology at the University of Munich under the direction of Wolfhard Pannenberg. So it was a very influential stage of my life that has impacted my scholarly career ever since.
And we are very honored to have you here today. Before we start, why have you studied the first chapters of the Bible in such detail?
The motivation behind this study was my desire to write a systematic philosophical theology. And I knew that in order to tackle a project like this, there were certain areas of theology where my thinking was still unsettled. I hadn't come to firm conclusions. And so I felt that I needed to really bone up on those areas of theology. One of these was the area of the atonement, how we should understand the way in which the cross of Christ reconciles us to God. But another area was the area of theological anthropology, and specifically the difficult question of the historical Adam. Are we as Christians committed to the historicity of an original human pair from whom all human beings on this planet are descended? And if we are committed to that biblically, then how do we reconcile such a position with the data of paleoanthropology concerning the antiquity and origin of man? So that was what originally motivated this study of the historical Adam.
And you've written, right, the book In Quest of the Historical Adam, and we want to get into that. You speak of the mytho-history. What exactly does it mean to interpret Genesis 1-11 as mytho-history, and what does it not mean?
In order to understand this designation, it's crucial that we appreciate the fact that the Bible is a collection of many different types or genre of literature. For example, in the Psalms, we have poetry. In the book of Acts, we have history. Proverbs, we have wisdom literature. In the book of Revelation, we have Jewish apocalyptic. And not all of these types of literature are to be interpreted literally. It would be an enormous hermeneutical mistake to interpret the book of Revelation with a kind of wooden literalism, because it is filled with symbolic words. Now, similarly, I believe that Genesis chapters 1 to 11 belong to a genre or type of literature that is not meant to be interpreted literally, but is filled with figurative and metaphorical language. And this is the genre of myth. And now, when I use the word myth, I am not talking about it in the popular sense, like the myth of the self-made man or the myth of the noble savage. Or the myth of a low-calorie diet. Rather, I'm using it in the sense that is used by the students of folklore to designate sacred, traditional narratives that seek to ground realities that are present to the author and his audience in events of the deep primordial past. And it seems to me that that is clearly the ambition of Genesis 1-11, the so-called primeval history of the book of Genesis. But this is not pure myth, because there is also a historical interest in these stories. This is meant to provide a historical prelude to the entire Pentateuch. And the primeval narratives of Genesis 1 to 11 are ordered by genealogies that meld seamlessly into Abraham and the patriarchs, who are indisputably regarded by the Pentateuchal author as historical persons. And that suggests that he also views Abraham's ancestors as historical individuals. So I use the designation of this type of literature that was proposed by the great Assyriologist Torkild Jacobsen of mytho-history. It is historical narrative, but it is described in the figurative and metaphorical language of myth, and therefore not to be interpreted literalistically.
Are there any other texts besides the first chapters of Genesis that we misunderstand if we don't read them mytho-historically? So maybe you could give us specific examples of texts where the mytho-historical character is very evident. That would be great. Thank you.
I haven't looked at other portions of the scriptures with this in mind, because my project was to examine these primeval narratives that speak of the origin of humanity. But I have seen classicists like George Kirk, for example, refer to things like the Iliad as belonging to this genre. There probably was a war between Athens and Troy, or was it between Sparta and Troy? I forget. But it's been infused with stories of deities and gods and so forth, and so represents a blend of the myth and historical genre.
So there are no other examples from today where we use that genre, right? Maybe in other cultures or...
Well, no, I just said that the classicist George Kirk and I think some others would say that Homer's Iliad would be an example of this type of genre.
Mm-hmm. Right, but no one who would write something today, like a newspaper
or
a letter.
No one today can write a myth in the sense that folklorists use the word, because myths are traditional narratives that are handed down in a society and are not new creations. So, for example, things like Star Wars, that says long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, is not an example of a genuine myth. That is a modern literary creation. A genuine myth needs to be a traditional sacred narrative that shapes a society.
So let's move on to Genesis 1 to 11. And please take time for that, because I think this is very important also for Christians and also for non-Christians who are interested in Christian belief. You say the evidence is very convincing that Genesis 1 to 11 is a text of the mytho-history genre. What evidence is there for this?
I list in the book In Quest of the Historical Adam about 9 family resemblances of this literary genre. The idea of family resemblances comes from Ludwig Wittgenstein, the Austrian philosopher, who pointed out that it's impossible to give a set of necessary and sufficient conditions that would define what a game is. Games are just too diverse to be able to find necessary and sufficient conditions for defining a game. But what Wittgenstein said is that there are certain family resemblances among games that enables us to classify them by how many of these family resemblances they might share. Now, the New Testament scholar, Richard Burridge, has used this same approach in classifying the Gospels as examples of ancient biography. Burridge made a list of the family resemblances among ancient biographies and then examined the Gospels in light of those family resemblances. And lo and behold, the Gospels exhibit a good number of these family resemblances and so deserve to be classed as of the genre of ancient biography. And this has changed New Testament gospel studies radically. Now, when you look at Genesis 1 to 11, in light of these nine family resemblances that I list, it is striking how many of these family resemblances Genesis 1 to 11 exhibit. They exhibit all of them except for one or two. And so I think this makes for a very compelling case that they do belong to this quasi-mythical genre. And I have yet to see anyone offer a genre analysis of Genesis 1 to 11 that gives an equally plausible explanation of the family resemblances of myth that these chapters exhibit.
Yeah, maybe you can point out these family resemblances. And also, especially, I think, the fantastic elements you mentioned in your book.
I define a fantastic element to be an element that, if taken literally, is patently false. Something that, if taken literally, it's patently false. And I think, for example, the creation of the world in six literal 24-hour days would qualify as a fantastic element in the narrative. And I think that there are indications in the text itself that the Pentateuchal author did not take these to be six consecutive 24-hour days of time in which the world was made. Another fantastic feature of the narratives would be the description of the anthropomorphic God that appears in chapters 2 and 3, who is walking in the cool of the garden, looking for Adam and Eve and calling out to them, and they're hiding from him in the foliage. In chapter 2, this same humanoid deity creates Adam like a statue out of dirt and then breathes into his nose. And Adam, the statue, comes alive, comes into a human being. And then later he extracts a rib out of the side of Adam while rendering him unconscious and creates a woman out of this rib. These actions of a humanoid deity, I think, are fantastic and are irreconcilable with the Pentateuchal author's presentation of God in chapter 1 as the transcendent creator of the universe rather than a material humanoid being living in the universe. So those would be a couple of examples of fantastic elements in the primeval narratives.
What would you say make them different when we compare, for example, I think you mentioned also the speaking snake in Genesis chapter 3, but there's also a speaking donkey in, I think, in the book of Numbers, or there is in the book of Exodus a flood, there are the plagues in Egypt. And why do you think are they different in Genesis 1 to 11?
Because that is the distinction between family resemblances and necessary and sufficient conditions. Finding one of these family resemblances is not a sufficient condition for classifying a piece of literature as myth. Obviously, there can be fantastic stories in legends and fables and fictions as well. But the claim here, again, is not that this is a list of necessary and sufficient conditions. It is the constellation of these family resemblances that give us reason to believe that in the primeval narratives, we are dealing with a mythical genre.
Genesis 1-11 also has a very clear narrative character. And I think that some people could think that that suggests that we are dealing with actual historical reporting rather than symbolism, especially when we consider that the text includes precise time markers like evening, morning, or exact lifespan down to the year. How would you think about that? How would you respond?
The idea of a narrative sequence of events is not indicative of a historical genre. Look at ancient Babylonian myths like the Enuma Elish, which describes Marduk's creation of the world out of the carcass of the dragon goddess Tiamat. There is a clear story there. There is a narrative sequence of events where Marduk slays Tiamat and then flays her like a fish, and out of her carcass creates the skies above, supported by certain supports and joints. And then he goes and does other things. There's clearly a sequence of events. Or in the Epic of Gilgamesh, you also have a narrative there of the exploits of Gilgamesh and his partner Enkidu. So that is not at all indicative of historical writing, because myths and fables and legends are also characterized by narrative sequence.
What about Genesis chapter 12 and beyond? Why do you think we are suddenly no longer faced with a mytho-historical text?
I think in Genesis 12, everything changes, and no longer do we have these great mythical themes like creation of the world, the origin of mankind, the worldwide flood, motifs that are also found in ancient Mesopotamian myths and myths around the world. You suddenly have a narrowing of the focus to the historical ancestors of the nation of Israel. And so it's a quite different style and type of writing. So if you pick up any commentary on the book of Genesis, you will find that it will be divided into three major sections. There will be the primeval history in Genesis 1 to 11. Then there will be the patriarchal narratives beginning in chapter 12. And then finally, you will have the story of Joseph and his brothers, which is a sort of novella to conclude the book. And so the writing in the remainder of the book of Genesis is very different than what you have in chapters 1 to 11.
But it seems unusual to mix the genre in one book, right? Or are there other examples where we have different genres in one book?
I don't think that that's at all unusual to have that sort of mixture. After all, in Genesis itself, you will have certain sections in poetry. In the primeval history itself, you have certain sections in poetry. And similarly, in the prophets, there will be certain poetic sections. So it's not unusual that you would find different literary genres in the same composition.
Maybe explain, how do you actually determine which statements in Genesis 1 to 11 are historical and which are mythical? And how do you differentiate between the two? I think to many of our listeners, this determination seems more arbitrary than systematic. So maybe you could explain that a little.
I'm not trying to make such a determination. And therefore, I don't think it's fair to say that it's arbitrary, because I'm not trying to do that. I suspect that mytho-history is much more like a mixture of coffee and cream than it is like red and blue marbles collected in a bag. And it would be impossible with coffee and cream to try to say, well, this part is cream and this part is coffee. the whole thing belongs to this literary genre. Now, what we can do, however, I believe, is identify certain elements that are figurative in nature rather than literal. One way in which we can do that is when the narrative states something that is in explicit contradiction to what the author says and believes elsewhere. And the prime example of that I've already given, namely the description of this humanoid deity in chapters 2 and 3 is completely at odds with what the Pentateuchal author himself believes and has described in chapter 1, where God is the transcendent creator of all physical reality, the heavens and the earth. And so we can be really sure, I think, that those descriptions in Genesis 2 and 3 are figurative and not literal. Another way would be if the elements are fantastic in the way I defined before. That is to say, if the author himself would have found a literal interpretation of these elements to be literally false. And I think, for example, the fruit trees in the garden, whose fruit, if eaten, magically conveys immortality or knowledge of good and evil. This is not miraculous fruit. It's very important to see this is not something that God supernaturally does, because they will confer their benefits even contrary to God's will. And that's why God drives Adam and Eve out of the garden, lest they eat of the tree of life and live forever. So this is power that is inherent within the fruit itself. It is a sort of magical tree that confers immortality or knowledge of good and evil, even contrary to God's will. These are not miraculous. So those would be examples, again, of things that I think are very plausibly to be taken to be figurative. And then yet another example would be things in Genesis 1 where I don't think the Pentateuchal author would have believed these to be literally true. For example, that the sun isn't created until the fourth day, or that the primordial ocean covering the earth drained away in just 24 hours. When you look at chapter 7 in the description of Noah's flood, it took months on end for the flood to drain away and the mountaintops to become visible. The idea that the primordial ocean drained away in 24 hours would not have been a belief that I think the Pentateuchal author would have accepted. And so that, again, would plausibly be, I think, a figurative element in the narratives.
I think that's important to underline what you just said, because some might think you are denying miracles or supernatural events, but that is totally not the intention. It is the question
It's neither the intention nor is it the fact. I am a supernaturalist, and I make this point quite clear in the book that I believe in miracles and supernatural realities. And that is why, contrary to many Old Testament commentators, I do not take the narrative in chapter 6 about the sons of God coming down from heaven and copulating with human females to sire a race of giants to be mythical or figurative. I think that's literal because it is miraculous. But that is very different from, for example, the trees in the garden or the talking snake or things of that sort. So we need to be very careful about distinguishing between miraculous or supernatural happenings and fantastic events.
Would you say that you are faced with more misunderstandings in this topic than in other areas?
Probably not, I think. I say that for two reasons. One, a lot of my work is on very subtle questions like middle knowledge. And I think probably nothing that I've written on has been so misunderstood as the doctrine of middle knowledge, simply because it is so difficult and subtle. Whereas in this case, I think that those who push back in many cases haven't even read what I've written. So it's not a matter of misunderstanding. It's more a matter of just misrepresenting. I think a misunderstanding is where you've actually engaged with the material, you've actually read it, and you didn't understand it. And I don't think that that's the problem here, because this is not difficult material to understand. It's pretty low bar, theoretically. And so if someone will simply read the book and engage with it, I doubt that the problem of misunderstanding really is going to be a significant one.
For this conversation today, we have also asked our listeners and some other people towards your interpretation. And I want you to read you something from a listener, and maybe you can comment on that question. The listener asks, I agree that there are easy and difficult passages in the Bible, such as Revelation. However, the Bible is characterized by the fact that God speaks to us in understandable language, even if we have to think about some statements for a while. However, the Bible does not contain a coded language that only initiates can decipher. The difficulty lies in the subject matter or limitations, not in any deliberate encryption by God. Does Mr. Craig really believe in a God who deliberately encrypted Genesis 1-11 so that only initiates, like Jacobson, can properly understand the text?
I wonder if our listener has ever read the book of Revelation. No one who has read that could think that the Bible doesn't contain encrypted language. That book is full of difficult symbols that make it very hard to understand. Moreover, in poetry, you have language that is not intended to be taken literally. In the Psalms, for example, God is sometimes described as a fire-breathing monster riding on the clouds of heaven in his chariot, or other times it speaks of God as having hands and eyes and ears. There are all sorts of literary metaphors that are used to describe God in poetic texts. So why does the listener think that God, if he's free to use poetry and free to use Jewish apocalyptic, is not free to use myth as a literary expression of his truth? And I don't think that this makes Genesis 1-11 difficult to understand. I think, as I say in the book, that we can identify, clearly, say 10 lessons that God would teach us out of the narratives of the primeval history that are very easy to grasp. So this is not language that requires you to have some kind of a decoder in order to understand. It just means you've got to be really cautious about being overly literal about what it says.
I think, I'm not sure about that, but maybe it is different because in Revelation, everyone in our time sees that this is difficult. There's no intuitively easy understanding to the pictures of Revelation. But when we read in Genesis 1 that God created the heaven and the earth in 6 days, that seems so clear. And why should that not be that clear meaning. Maybe it's that's the background.
All right. Because these narratives exhibit the family resemblances of myth. And when you look at myths, they are not always to be interpreted literalistically. They are filled with symbolism and figurative language. And as I indicated, there are clues in the narrative itself that the Pentateuchal author did not interpret these narratives literally. And these are listed in the book. I go into them in some detail. I've already mentioned a couple, like the draining away of the primordial ocean in just 24 hours, in contrast to the draining away of the flood of Noah that returned the earth to its primeval state, or the creation of the sun and the moon and the stars on the fourth day, even though there was clearly light before the creation of those bodies, and many other aspects of the primeval narrative. So I'm simply asking, are we obliged as Jews, Christians, and Muslims to read these narratives with a sort of wooden literalism? And I would say that that is not the best understanding of the text, that the text doesn't belong to that sort of literary genre.
Yes, thank you. I think one problem also is that if someone would read the Bible in, for example, the verses in Exodus 20 or 31, for both times it says that God created heaven and the earth in 6 days, I think that someone could come to the conclusion, okay, if this statement about the six-day creation appears in those different places, then that is probably exactly what it means. How would you answer that, and how would you explain to the reader that this is different?
What I would say there is that the Pentateuchal author is looking back to his creation narrative in Genesis chapter 1, and he is reiterating or repeating what the creation narrative says, that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. So this isn't meant to be providing some sort of a literal statement. It's a literary statement about what the creation narrative in Genesis 1 says. And this is actually one of the best examples of a family resemblance that characterizes myth. Myth seeks to ground realities present to the author and his audience in events deep in the primordial past. And no better example of that can be found than the Pentateuchal author's grounding Jewish Sabbath observance in the creation story. The reason that Jews rest on the Sabbath, on the seventh day, is because in the creation story, God rests on the seventh day. So this is clearly an effort on the author's part to ground this very distinctive feature of Jewish culture and religion, namely Sabbath observance, in these events of the primordial past. And that is exactly one of the purposes of myth, is to do that.
Let's think about another, I think, major problem for many Christians. If I understood you correctly, from your interpretation of Genesis 1 to 11, it does not follow that death has existed before the fall, right?
I would say that would be a natural way to read it. It doesn't say, but if it's not meant to be taken in a literal way, that would seem to imply that, yes, there was animal predation and death prior to the creation of Adam and Eve.
And what would you say, why do you think doesn't God create a perfect functioning ecosystem that did not require death? Because that seems logical possible, right?
Oh, it could be logically possible, but not physically plausible. I think that any viable ecosystem is going to have animal predation in order to be viable. Otherwise, over time, the insects would eat all the vegetation and everything would die off. Such an ecosystem is impossible without animal predation. And so I think God wanted to create a viable ecosystem on this planet that would set the stage then for the eventual drama of human salvation that will be played out on this planet. So what goes on prior to the creation of humanity is setting the stage for this great human drama of the plan of salvation. And involving animal predation and death is a good feature of such an ecosystem. In fact, in the Psalms, the psalmist says that the young lions roar and God provides their food for them. So I don't think that the author of the Pentateuch would have been deeply disturbed about the idea of animal predation and death prior to the fall.
But the Bible also indicates that God will make a new heaven and a new earth where this does not seem to be any more animal death and animal pain. So wouldn't it be better if God would just created this world without this death?
We don't know what the eschaton is going to be like. My wife believes and hopes that our pets will be in heaven. She hopes that there will be animals in heaven, but I don't think biblically we know the answer to that question. But if that is, it might involve a world that would be so operating according to the laws of nature, so different from ours, that it wouldn't be suitable for the playing out of the human drama of salvation. God has created us on this planet at arm's length, so to speak. He doesn't overwhelm us with the obviousness of his existence. We do not see God in all his glory and majesty and attractiveness. And that allows for a kind of veil of decision-making during which human beings can decide for or against God and makes the possibility of disobedience a real one. And I suspect that in the world to come, that sort of freedom to sin will be removed. We can have freedom to do other sorts of things, but I suspect that once we're with Christ in heaven, that the glory of God and the attractiveness of his person will be so overwhelming that the freedom to sin will be removed. And so maybe in such a world, maybe there could be animals that that don't need predation in order to survive.
Another difficulty that I think some atheists point out is that the animals not just die, but they also suffer from pain. And if I saw it correctly, is that you would say that the animals suffer different than humans? But I think you base your answer on a nearly 20-year-old study by Michael Murray, if that is right, which may no longer reflect the current state of research on pain perception in animals. What would your take on that?
Two things. First of all, as in dealing with any problem of natural evil, my primary point is that God in his providence creates a world such that there are justifying goods for permitting suffering and pain in the world. It is permissible to permit persons or animals to suffer if there is some morally sufficient reason that justifies the permission of that. And as I said a moment ago, I think that bringing people into an eternal, saving relationship with God is an incommensurable good to which the pain and suffering in this life cannot even be compared. And I think it not at all improbable that only in a world suffused with natural and moral evil that the optimal number of persons would freely come to know God and his salvation. What the atheist would have to prove is that there is a world available to God involving less suffering than this world, but in which an equal or greater number of people or percentage of people come to know God and find his salvation freely. And that's pure speculation. There is no way that the atheist could justify such a hypothesis. But then the other thing to which you referred is that Michael Murray's work on animal pain helps to really diminish the anguish of animal suffering that I think all of us feel, especially those of us who are pet owners. Because what Murray shows is that there are different levels or thresholds of pain awareness. At the very lowest level will just be aversive reactions to noxious stimuli. So, for example, if you poke an amoeba with a needle, it will recoil and pull away. And this would be the sort of reactions that lower level animals like bacteria and insects will exhibit. A higher level of pain awareness would be had by sentient animals, animals which have states of consciousness. So when you get to the level of vertebrates, for example, there you do have a genuine phenomenal consciousness of pain. Dogs and cats and horses and cows feel pain. But there is yet a third level of pain awareness, which is the self-consciousness that one is oneself in pain. And in order to have this level of self-consciousness, one needs to have a first-person perspective to be able to say, my arm hurts, I injured my back, or something of that sort. And animals do not exhibit this kind of first-person perspective or self-conscious behavior. And therefore, even though they are in pain, they have that second level phenomenal experience of pain. They are not aware that they are themselves in pain. And thus God has spared animals, I think, the deepest anguish that comes through human pain, where one is not only in pain, but one is aware that one is oneself in pain. And Murray's work is still validated by the cutting-edge research on animal consciousness. During the last decade, new journals of research into animal consciousness have been founded, and scientists continue to explore the different states of animal consciousness. And this is reported in the second volume 2B of my forthcoming Systematic Philosophical Theology, and also in volume 3 on the doctrine of creation, where I deal with the question of animal pain. And so the notion that animals, though conscious, do not have this first-person awareness remains a valid insight of animal consciousness research.
Maybe now one final question, which is maybe also a worry of many Christians, that once you categorize Genesis 1 to 11 as mythical history, the worry becomes, don't you create a precedent that opens the door to reinterpreting other central biblical texts, like the Exodus or even the resurrection, as merely literally constructs? How would you respond to that?
Well, think about that question. If I interpret the Psalms as poetry, does that open the door to my interpreting other aspects of Scripture like Exodus or the resurrection of Jesus as poetry? Or if I interpret the book of Revelation as Jewish apocalyptic literature, does that open the door to my interpreting the book of Acts as apocalyptic literature? Well, in a theoretical sense, certainly it opens the door in the sense that you need to look at these other types of literature contained in the Bible and ask yourself, to what genre of literature do these belong? But I think there's very little danger that you will find these other passages exhibiting the family resemblances of mytho-history. Take the resurrection of Jesus as a showcase example of this. During the 19th century, during the so-called Religionsgeschichtliche Schule, biblical scholars tried to show that the resurrection of Jesus was derived from pagan myths of dying and rising gods. And some of them even sought to explain the origin of the disciples' belief in Jesus' resurrection as due to the influence of these pagan myths. Well, that interpretation of the Gospels was completely exploded. It was shown, first of all, that these myths were not, in fact, parallel to the Gospels, which are historical narratives concerned with historical people, whereas these myths were merely symbolic and figurative narratives about the crop cycle. The god represents the crops, which die during the dry season, and then they come back to life during the rainy season. And so you have this repetitive cycle of death and rebirth in these myths of dying and rising gods. But then secondly, there was absolutely no causal connection between these myths and the first disciples. Jews were aware of these pagan myths, and they found them abhorrent. And so the idea that the disciples came to believe that Jesus was risen from the dead because they had heard about Egyptian myths of Osiris or Greek myths of Adonis was just absurd. And so today, myth is an irrelevant category in gospel studies. You may be surprised to know that in gospel studies, as I say, as a result of the work of Richard Burridge, the gospels are regarded as closest to the genre of ancient biography, which has a strong historical interest. And so the question of myth with regard to the gospels, the resurrection of Jesus, it's not even on the radar screen anymore. It's become an irrelevancy. So you need to simply honestly examine these various biblical pieces of literature on a case-by-case basis and do a genre analysis of them, and then interpret them with a hermeneutic that is appropriate to the type of literature that you've identified. And there's no reason that we as Christians need to be afraid of that procedure. In fact, honestly, I'll be frank with you, what I fear more is Christians who do not do such a genre analysis and therefore adopt hermeneutical approaches to biblical literature that are completely inappropriate to the type of literature in question and therefore lead the Christian church to false conclusions.
Dr. Craig, thank you so much for this conversation, but also for your investigation in this very important area. Was there ever a moment where you feared that you have to give up the belief in a historical Adam?
Oh, listen, when I began this, I did so with a great deal of trepidation because I wanted to pursue my study of the historical Adam objectively and to follow the evidence where it leads. And so I was very nervous about this. And I even ran some of my conclusions past colleagues whom I respect and said, am I on the wrong path? Am I going the wrong way here? And to a man, they encouraged me in the work that I had done, the conclusions that I was coming to. And so I want our listeners to understand that this was not done in any sense in a flippant or cavalier sense. This was deeply anguishing to me to explore these questions. And it was gratifying that in the end, I did come to the position that there is a historical, or was a historical, Adam and Eve from whom every human being on this planet is descended. That hasn't come out yet in this interview. What is important to understand is that my work is a robust defense of the historical Adam and Eve and their universal progenitorship of all mankind, which theologians on the left gave up long ago. So this work that I've done is a marriage of biblical hermeneutics and then scientific study from paleontology, paleoanthropology, and archaeology with a view toward determining if there was an original human pair and if there was, exactly when they lived. And so the place I ended up with, the place I ended up at in this book for me was tremendously gratifying. And when I look now at these primeval narratives in Genesis 1 to 11, I think, how could I have ever read them any other way? But once you put on these new lenses, these new glasses, you think, well, of course, this is historical narratives described with the figurative and metaphorical language of myth.
Dr. Craig, thank you so much. This was very insightful and very helpful, and I hope it will be also very helpful for our listeners. And thank you also for your work in philosophy and theology. There's so much we can learn from you, also in Germany. We are very grateful for your work. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Today.
Thank you. That's very kind. And anything I can do to be of encouragement to German brothers and sisters, I am eager to do so.
As always, we are very interested to hear what you think about this episode. Let us know through our usual channels and have a great day. See you soon. Bye.